Hello, and welcome to Be the Serpent, a podcast of extremely deep literary merit, with your classy and sophisticated hosts, Alexandra Rowland, Freya Mosk, and Jennifer Mace. On today's episode, we're discussing Those Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin and Victory Conditions by Ostolat. Welcome to episode one, False Utopias and Robot Sex. I'm Alex, the American one.
I'm Freya, the Australian one.
I'm Macy, the English one.
We are three redheaded fantasy authors.
And today we're talking about robot boners.
Well, technically, this is not the one with boners. This is the one with cables, which is totally different.
Totally different. Now, tell us more about that, Macy.
But first, I have a question.
What's your question?
Why are we talking about robot boners?
That's a great question. Why are we talking about robot boners?
Because they are relevant to the topic at hand, amazingly.
And what is the topic at hand, Freya?
So I think we were going to start off by talking a little bit about some of the terms that are used in fantasy. And I'm going to let Alex introduce Hope Punk.
So the Tumblr post that I made said that Hope Punk is the opposite of Grimdark, which was a little bit... It was almost right, because Hope Punk is an opposite of Grimdark. There's another one which people brought to my attention called Noblebright. And Noblebright is what you picture when you picture Arthurian legends. Noblebright means that everyone is essentially good and evil is an outlier, and that we can defeat evil by sending an errant knight off to do battle with the dragon or to defeat the evil wizard. And once they're gone, and the world returns to an equilibrium of basic goodness.
So do you think Noblebright, this was something that I was trying to think about when I was reading it, does Noblebright center around the idea of one person being either a figurehead or a chosen one, or obviously, you know, the king whose golden rule means that the world is also good? Or do you think it's something that can be applied on a larger scale, like a population scale?
I think that in Noblebright, yeah, you do generally have one person who is sort of a figurehead. And this is, I think this comes down to a term in mythology studies called the hieros gamos, which means the sacred marriage. And the sacred marriage says that if the relationship between the king and the queen is good and healthy and happy and prosperous, then the relationship between the king and the kingdom will be healthy and prosperous as well. So if the king and queen have a good marriage, then the king and the kingdom have a good quote-unquote marriage as well. So the king is sort of the figurehead in this situation. If he's a good king, then everything around him is affected by that. And everything around him is made better by his goodness.
I suppose that's where you get those Shakespearean kind of things where they talk about if something is wrong, either in the state of Denmark or in, I think it's Julius Caesar, they talk about omens a lot, that this is a sign that something is wrong with the leader because it just spills out and there's something wrong with the land because that Noblebright has been lost.
I think it's an interesting interplay. Like, in today's society, everybody wants to be able to do something about whatever it is that's bad in the world. And I wonder if this concept of Noblebright and if you aren't being a perfect person, you have spoiled it, comes into play in some of the purity politics we sometimes see online.
I think that yes, because purity is something that is very tempting. The kind of Noblebright situation is something that we all instinctively long for because we understand it as part of our mythology and part of our sort of cultural bones.
I think to me this is what drew me when I first read your Hope Punk post to the idea of Hope Punk as an alternative to that, because Hope Punk is very much about you do the little things. You plant the tomato seeds in the middle of the apocalypse because that's all you can do is small acts of kindness, but they are real nonetheless. That just because you can't be perfect doesn't mean you can't do anything.
Yeah, and I think that it makes it an achievable. It's an achievable thing to strive towards. You can imagine yourself in that situation thinking, I can't do much, but I can do this. And I think in that way, it does tie in a little bit to the purity politics, which is trying to say that you can't do anything wrong. You have to do everything good all the time. And this is saying, well, okay, everything might be falling down around you, but you can plant some tomato seeds and then good job. That's your one thing that you've done today.
So the other thing that I wanted to say about Hope Punk real quick was that it's also about forgiveness of, well, maybe not forgiveness. Forgiveness isn't quite the right word. Acceptance. It's about acceptance of imperfection. Whereas in Noble Bright, there's no room for being imperfect. There, if you do something bad, then you're a bad person. Whereas in Hope Punk, if you do something bad, you did a bad thing, and you can then go and make up for it. And maybe you did something really, really bad and you're going to be working for a long, long, long time to make up for that bad thing. But it's forgiving, and it means that maybe you suck today, but as long as you try to suck less tomorrow, then that's worthwhile. And that's a reason to keep trying. So yes, why is it relevant to robot boners?
So I think we came up with the idea to this podcast a little bit because we were all reading a fic, a piece of fanfic. Freya and I were reading a piece of fanfic, and we then cruelly bullied Alex into reading about giant robots.
Yes. Yes, that is what happened. Before we go any further, so the fanfiction that we're talking about is Victory Condition by Astolat, which we will link to in the description. And this is a explicit piece of fanfiction about Transformers, which I was not ever expecting to read Transformers fanfiction or to have it affect my heart in any way, but here we are.
Look, the thing is, nobody ever expects to be dragged anywhere by Astolat, and yet it just keeps happening anyway.
Yes.
And then you end up with people like myself who have no idea about what is a Transformer beyond the one Michael Bay movie that I think I watched, possibly, in the past, maybe while drunk. And then you end up reading these very long and very engrossing fics, and you just go with it. And then you inflict it on other people,
and so
which is what we've done.
I think one of the things that Astolat does with these is she creates a world that, again, I don't know enough about Transformers to say if this is actually the world of Transformers.
But, real quick. I don't know anything about Transformers. Freya doesn't know anything about Transformers. And Macy doesn't know anything about Transformers. Are we all on the same page?
Yes.
Great. Please,
okay,
continue.
Okay. My point is that the Transformers setup seems to me to be a fairly simplistic cartoon in some ways about good versus evil. And you have the good Autobots who want to protect humans and be kind to people. And then you have the evil, rebellious, oh, drat, what's the name?
Decepticons.
Who want to break everything and hurt people. And Astolat takes that and breaks your brain on it.
Yeah, honestly, in the first one that I read, it took me until about two-thirds of the way through the fic to work out that the Decepticons were meant to be the bad guys because of the way she was writing it. And I think there is a more modern... I've seen a lot of people talking about a particular comic that's coming out at the moment, which has made it, I think, a bit more complicated. But certainly what she's writing is an original series.
And I think that's the fascinating thing about fan fiction is, and transformative works in general, is it lets you take an original piece of work and kind of pull it apart and use it and in conversation with it to explore a whole bunch of ideas. And the idea that Astolat is exploring here is that the Decepticons, who rebelled and brought down the golden era of the robots, were doing so for reasons. And I think that gets back to Noble Bright.
Yes, because in Noble Bright, evil is usually just evil for the sake of evil. Like, they want to take over the world, but then they don't ever really have a plan for what they're going to do after that. You know, like, Voldemort doesn't have a plan for the economy. Voldemort doesn't really have a foreign policy. You know, he wants to wipe out all the Muggleborns, but... okay, what then? Like, once you get your hands on ultimate power, what's she gonna do with it?
Right. Whereas in this piece of fiction, the Decepticon leader has a very clear idea of what he's going to do. But I also meant that the robot golden age is kind of a Noble Bright utopia, right?
Yeah.
And one of the questions I think I found myself asking about this, about utopias as a concept, is utopia just a dystopia where we don't see who's paying the price?
Yes. Yes. 100% yes.
Because I was thinking about The Hunger Games as a utopia. Like, I am convinced if you gave me a month and no day job, I could sit down and write you a story that would convince you from the perspective of District 1 that Hunger Games was a utopia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's weird.
That is extremely weird. Now, I know that we were planning on maybe dividing this up a little bit and talking about things in sections, but the Victory Conditions is so much in conversation with the Ursula K. Le Guin short story that we're talking about today that I think that there's no way for us to separate them out, because I have some things to say about that as well, which are on this topic. Mm-hmm. So the story is The Ones Who Walk Away from Omalas, which is an incredible piece of work. I have seen people call it a perfect short story, which is... I'm not sure that I can actually call it a short story, because it's in the short story format, but it's doing something that short stories don't often do.
It's a philosophy experiment, essentially.
I actually have a quote from Amal Al-Matar here. And one of the things she says about writing short stories, which she writes amazing short stories and poetry, she says, some stories have plots that are made of mechanical parts where one cog turns and affects another. But sometimes the story is in the movement of eyes over a sculpture. And I think that's what we're seeing here. There isn't a story in Omalas per se, but there is a journey that this piece of fiction takes you on through this world that Ursula Le Guin has created. And it's a different form.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting point about a sculpture that your eyes are moving over. It's almost like those paintings that are designed, a good painting will tell your eyes where to go. You follow a line somewhere, you follow the pointing finger, your eyes should move in a predictable way down the canvas. And that's essentially what she's doing, is that she's created a portrait of a place. But the reason it works as a story and the reason it's so effective is that Le Guin is very effective in guiding your eyes across very particular parts of the canvas in order to show you the whole.
The form that I see this piece of literature taking is a Zen koan, because it's asking a question that doesn't have an answer.
Hmm. Perhaps we should say what the story is, for not everyone will have read it.
Okay, so essentially, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omalas is a brief piece, as we've said, and it essentially describes to you a society that seems like it is impossibly perfect. So it gives you, these nice descriptions of what happens and the ways that the people are happy and the things that this society has and the things that it doesn't have. And it lets you sink into this description, and you're already asking the question by the time you get through, all right, what is the catch? Is there a catch? And basically it turns out the catch, and this is the whole point of the story, is that this is a society which is near perfect for every member of the society except for one, who is a child that is terribly mistreated and has to be terribly mistreated for everybody else's happiness to exist. And the point of the story is that every other member of that society is aware of the existence and the suffering of that child. And the title, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omalas, only comes up in the very last paragraph, where it says that most people will look upon the price of their happiness and learn to accept it, but they'll keep it in their minds throughout their life, and it's what allows them to be compassionate. But a very few people will look upon the cost of this utopia or the cost of their society and decide that they don't want to stay and that it's not a price they want to pay, and they leave.
This piece is laying out two things, and one of them is it's an example of the very famous philosophical quandary involving the railroad tracks, and there's the railroad tracks split in two, and on one there's one person tied up, and if the train goes that way, then that person will get run over and that person will die. And on the other set of railroad tracks, there's five people all tied up. And you have to choose, you, a bystander, has to choose which one is more ethical, which one is right. Is it right to sacrifice one person to save five people? Does it matter at all? And that's the question that the story is initially putting in front of you. That's the first question that the story wants you to see. But I posit that that question is a distraction from the real question. And the real question is, let me bring up Omelas here. So there's exactly one line in this story that stood out to me more than all the others, which is, the terms are strict and absolute. There may not even be a kind word spoken to the child. The terms are strict and absolute. Hmm. So the real question that we should be asking is not, what are the citizens of Omelas doing? Like, are they right to walk away? Are they right to accept what is going on in their society? The question we should be asking here is, who set the terms?
I did not notice that line. That is a great question.
Well, it's definitely something that is definitely, I think you're right, it's a question that's posed. It's not necessarily one that it wants you to answer, but I think it's tied into the fact that there are people leaving, because these people are saying that they do not accept the terms that have been set.
But we see a similar kind of thing happening in our media today with our politics, where people would prefer to distract you with the middle class fighting with the lower class. Oh, the lower class are exploiting the system, et cetera, so that you don't notice the people at the top sticking their hands into the cookie jar. Because if the terms are this one child has to suffer so that all of the rest of you can be happy, who was the one who said the child has to suffer? And where are they? And where's the nearest guillotine?
And I think that that is the question that Victory Condition asks and answers with the Decepticon Rebellion, right? Because this is there are some very close parallels between the ones who walk away from Omelas, deliberately, I'm sure, and this fanfic, where the main bad character, the main villain, is born to be locked away in a deep hole to mine for the leader of the Golden Utopia, and isn't even given the ability to feel curiosity. And I think that's a very clear... Right? I'm pretty sure Megatron is the child.
Megatron is the child. I did not notice that. Well done.
Close reading of fanfic. Well done.
That is so interesting, because I've seen a lot of people, you know, criticizing Omelas for various things, and I don't want to repeat their arguments because I'm going to grossly oversimplify them. But one of them is that, like, the child doesn't...
Have agency,
yes. And, of course, that's the point, that the child can't have agency. But...
Whereas in this
That's so interesting. In the fic, we are basically from the perspective of the child.
Right.
That's so good.
In this fic, the child breaks away, and the child murders the leader of the utopia who put him in the hole.
Yes.
Right?
But at the same time, I think it's also, there's something almost cyclical about it, because then the world that the leader of the Decepticons is describing as the ideal and the thing that he is trying to achieve with the war is
on the kingdom of knives, right?
The kingdom of knives, yes, or the empire of knives, with the idea being that everything might be horrible and violent, and you might have to fight for, you know, every inch of your own freedom, but at least everybody is in the same boat and nobody is pretending to be better than anyone else. That is Omelas. The Kingdom of Knives is still Omelas. Is just saying that if you are going to accept your freedom at the price of suffering, and with being transparent about the suffering, everyone should be on the same page. But everyone takes part. Everyone is the child rather than one person being the child. Because you're free, you might be unhappy, but you are free and honest, and nobody is pretending that it is a golden age. That to me was the point of the story. The very last section of it, the very last conversations and poems are about the glimpse of what might be beyond it if there is a solution that is better than that, the one that the people who are walking away are trying to find.
I think that that's, and this maybe pivots us back to another thing I wanted to talk about, but I think that the idea that Megatron comes out of the darkness with is, if everything is honest and everybody tries to take what they want, then there will be violence and war and strife all the time. And I think that the thing that Optimus Prime, who is the other party in this story, counters with is, no, sometimes people will just choose to be kind, right? And that is Hope Punk.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yes. It arrives at Hope Punk in the middle because what Megatron is coming from is basically straight up grimdark. Everyone is going to kill each other constantly. We're all going to be on the same level. And Optimus Prime is coming from a place of at least a past of what he perceived as Noble Bright. And they arrive together in the middle at something that looks like Hope Punk.
And this is why it matters that it is smutty fanfic, because the way they do that, and this is something that fascinates me about fanfic, is because it's a genre where sex is written about openly, people world build the heck out of their sex.
Tell us everything about that.
Yes, I will tell you everything about robot boners, except not. The really cool thing about this story is, and the way that Astolat has world built the robots, is their way of having sex is almost closer to a Vulcan mind meld.
It's the drift, essentially.
Right. You join your thoughts to another person, and you experience their thoughts and their emotions kind of from the inside.
Yes, from a very subjective kind of viewpoint, yeah.
Right, and that's so cool to me, because that's how the Grimdark and the Noble Bright become the Hope Punk.
Yes, I have some thoughts on this, because I thought that was a very interesting way of, you're right, of conceptualizing this idea of, you know, fully seeing someone is the way to have compassion, or a way to have compassion for them. And you're right that this is a very common trope, the mind meld, the drift in Pacific Rim, and it's something that we see a lot in fan fiction. Like, it's a very common and very appealing romantic trope, this idea of a mind meld and having your mind totally joined with somebody else's. And I think it comes down again to this idea that if someone sees you fully and accepts what they have seen, then that's, you know, that's the ideal, because we as humans can never fully see and never fully conceptualize somebody else, and we can never be seen fully ourselves. But there's something very appealing about the idea that someone has seen you fully and accepts you anyway and loves you anyway. So this is this idea of transparency and seeing something fully and accepting something fully. And in the Omelas context, what is being seen and accepted is the necessary degradation, the necessary evil, the existence of the child. In the trope of fiction, it's about being totally seen and loved for who you are. And that's a part of this story as well. And so what happens is that you have this marriage of transparency and love. And that is what the Invisible City is in this story. It is the idea of seeing and being brutally honest, but introducing love and compassion into that. And that's where you find Hope Punk, but it's also where you find the third path that they refer to at the end.
Walking away.
That walking away. And that's why I think the robot sex is very thematically appropriate. Mic drop.
How did you guys feel? What is your opinion about the people, the ones who walk away? Like, what did you think that they were doing? How do you, what was your emotions in response to them?
I think it's tough. It's two things, right? It's a dereliction, but it's also a rebellion, right? They don't try to help. They don't feel that they can destroy the paradise for others. And my question was, surely someone has.
Yes, so it reminded me particularly of a quote from Reverend Martin Luther King, the white moderate who's more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal that you seek, but I can't agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically feels he can set the timetable for another man's freedom. So the ones who walk away are essentially doing nothing. They're saying, the stand that I'm taking is that I don't want to take a stand. And so I will leave so that I will not be part of this.
I think if you think about the train track problem, I've just been trying to run this in my head, because the whole point of the train track problem as an ethical dilemma is that the train is heading for the five people, even before you get to the magical button or whatever it is. So the choice that you have to make is you get to switch the train onto the one person, or you do nothing and the five people die. The idea is, do you have agency in one person's death, or are you passive in five people? And so the idea of walking away, it's almost the other way around. It's almost like the train track. At the moment, the train is definitely heading for that one person who is suffering, who is dying. And if you walk in and say, no, we need to be kind to this one person, but we'll disrupt things, you are pressing the button that then moves it to kill five people. So what they're essentially doing is refusing to press the button.
Yes. I don't know. I think that I'm coming down a little bit on Alex's side of this, I think, because it's almost like you are saying that your own ability to be innocent is more important, right? It's, I don't know if you guys watched the Doctor Who episode that riffs off of Omelas as well, the one on the space station with the whale.
I remember it, but it has been so long since I have seen it, so tell me about it again.
Basically, everyone knew what was happening, but they pretended they didn't, whereas in Omelas, I think that they don't even pretend, right?
Oh, it was the whale that was suffering. The whale was the child in that situation, right?
Right. And the question is, who has the right to make that decision?
Well, I think the thing is that you don't know. This is the point with the story. I think obviously there is that ambiguity, and the ambiguity at the end is saying that we do not know where they're going. We do not know, you know, what they're heading for. You don't know, are they heading for somewhere where they can create a different type of world? Or are they getting some space from this so that they can then come back and tear it down? Like, there are ways of looking at it by saying that, you know, if you don't want to exist within this bargain, then you can walk away. But maybe they're walking away to find out who set those terms in the first place.
So here's a question. Is it the difference between saying, I will fix the society I'm in versus I will go found a new one? Like, and how that echoes in our own communities and situation right now, Alex, you and I.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've chosen to live in America, and it's a choice that I ask myself about a lot, because in a lot of...
Hell, it's a choice that I ask myself about a lot.
Right. So do we choose to try to stay and fight, or do we... Where do we say, I have to protect myself and leave? And where's the ethics in that? Because if we have the power and, frankly, the privilege to be physically able to leave, that's a huge thing, right?
Yes.
I think bringing it back to the reason I'm being so lenient about this is that I am thinking always about bringing it back to victory conditions.
Yes.
And the whole point of that is that at the end, these people cannot walk away from the society physically. They have to keep on living in the world that they're existing in, but they make the decision to try and find the external solution, or the third path, or the invisible city, or whatever you want to call it, while still existing in their society and trying to make it fairer, like trying to get closer to the Empire of Knives, that which is Omelas, than whatever it is that exists before it. But they are still going to live in that society.
Yes.
While they search for the third option. So I think in Omelas it's very concrete. They actually, they have the ability to walk away physically. But in Victory Condition, it's saying you can look at the compromise that you've made, you can accept it, you can be transparent, and you can still try to drag hope and compassion in and use them to build something better, even if you're not quite sure what it would look like or how it would work or if you're ever going to see it yourself. And I think that is the hope punk, because it's saying you can't walk away.
I think that... To me, the biggest tool of Noble Bright and false utopia is self-delusion. And I think that that's what this fic is fighting. This fic basically takes Optimus Prime and breaks him of his self-delusion. And I think that a lot of people have this belief about how everything was once perfect. And I think, Alex, you wanted to talk a little bit about this. With Strong Time.
Strong Time, yes. So this is another mythological concept. The more common term in the academic mythological circles is Dreamtime, but a couple of people very kindly pointed out to me that Dreamtime has some colonialist overtones since it was essentially appropriated from Australian Aboriginal culture. So we'll be using Strongtime to mean the academic term and Dreamtime to mean the Australian Aboriginal term, if that comes up. Strongtime is the chronological time when Once Upon a Time happened, or a very long time ago and half the world away. It's the time when stories happen. And Noble Bright is very much a part of Strongtime. Strongtime is the good old days when women were strong and men were beautiful and heroes walked the earth. And when people were better, decent people. It's essentially weaponized nostalgia is what it comes down to.
And the whole point of it is obviously that it's always shifting. Like every single generation has its own, when I was young and back in the day. And, you know, you go back to the writings in ancient Greece about how young people these days are ruining everything.
Yes.
And then every generation since then has young people are ruining everything. And back in the day, everything was great. And that's why it's nostalgia, because it can never actually be a real time that you can point back to and say in the year dot, because if you look at in the year dot, there were people there saying, oh, back in my day.
Yes, novels are going to destroy women.
And the only your day that ever happened was when you were a child and you were too young to notice that there was anything going on. You were tiny and small and a lot of stuff went over your head. And then you grow up and you get taller. And the stuff that was going over your head is now hitting you in the middle of the face. And you ask yourself, oh my God, where did this come from? This all suddenly started happening. Except no, it always was happening. It's just that now you grew up enough to notice and you're so tall now that it's not going over your head.
Who got all this politics in my lovely science fiction and fantasy?
Yes, exactly. Oh my God, those guys.
Tell us how you really feel.
Oh my gosh. Let's not.
But yes, Strongtime.
Strongtime, right. So what was the question? What were we talking about there?
The idea of a false golden age. And the idea and that anything that's based on a golden age is about self-delusion.
Yes, 100%. And nostalgia, because any golden age that you feel yourself, that you experienced, was based in your own naivety and your own ignorance and the fact that you can only concentrate on a couple things at one time. So of course you're going to miss stuff. Of course you're not going to notice anything. That's totally natural. That's totally fine. But eventually you do start noticing things and you start looking outside yourself and you see that other people don't have the same life experiences that you do. And that's scary to start out with.
And that's the realization that it comes into Victory Conditions, where Optimus Prime has to think that what he's actually trying to build, and he realizes what he's trying to recapture is his own memory of what it was like to live in that golden age before he realized that it was built on the backs of suffering. And then the second realization is the one that if he had grown old enough in that world, or if he had continued, if that world had continued for long enough, he would have reached the realization by another path. Like, they're talking quite literally about these ideas of a world that's constantly built on the back of oppression and is constantly building itself higher, people having to live in these underlayers. And he comes to the realization that eventually the, you know, wonderful top layer that he would have lived in would have been buried and he would have woken up to the lie or whatever it was that he realizes.
But by then it would be too late.
And then it would be too late to do anything about it. And that's the pivotal moment of his particular realization that the thing he'd been trying to fight for is something that never actually existed. It was just his idealized memories of a time that he thought was perfect, but was in fact built on oppression, like any good utopia.
And I think that that's the cool thing that The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas does, is that nostalgia, that belief in perfection, is not something the characters have. It's something the reader has.
Yes, that's true.
I think that's really cool.
And that's the way it's shown to you as well. It's very, very deliberately. Le Guin gives you this beautiful picture and she shows you all of the bright colours and things like that. And she
uses your cultural, mythological background, the one that is baked into you with fairy tales when you're a child.
Yes, exactly. She says, here is a beautiful, beautiful society. Oh, look, here's the rotting core at the heart. And it does make you think about, it makes you think about your own, the other beautiful, beautiful societies that have been shown to you in, you know, perhaps a classical noble bride fantasy story, and say, well, where was the rotting heart of that one? Was it just somewhere where we couldn't see? Or was it in plain sight, but it was ignored?
Basically, everything is always unreliable narrators all of the time, always.
I feel like we should just staple that to the podcast somewhere.
Everything is unreliable narrators all the time, always. The Alex Rowland story.
Sorry. Unreliable narrators, take a shot.
Oh, you are welcome. Okay, so we're not talking about Nirvana in Fire this time, but soon.
Yes.
Soon, yes.
So I think we've covered quite a lot of things in this episode.
We have. Did you want to talk more about robot sex from a computer science perspective?
Please do.
I just feel like we haven't talked enough about robot boners in this episode.
Listen, all right. So for those of you listening at home, I threatened something thinking that these two would rein me in. And unfortunately, the opposite has occurred. And so...
Hold on. Can you hang on? I just need to get my popcorn.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Oh okay, my gosh. Go.
Listen, okay. I feel typecast right now. So Astolat clearly has a computer science background of some kind, because in this story, the way that the interaction between the two robots' thoughts is described in computer science terminology. And I find it really hilarious, frankly, that as we are publishing this episode, I don't know if any of you noticed the security vulnerabilities that came out early in January.
I think you can assume we didn't.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So basically, the computer science community discovered that all CPUs, which is the chip that your computer runs on, are fucked. And
all of them?
Yes. Anything that has been written by Intel is definitely fucked. Anything else is theoretically fucked, but they haven't got a proof of concept yet.
Why?
Okay, so basically it is possible to read what happened on your computer by spoofing other activity on that chip. So anybody, for example, could get your browser to report what you typed in another tab. And I don't know about you two, but I type a lot of passwords on my computer.
Mm, yeah.
So this is why everybody got a Windows update. But it is a security attack that involves processes reading other processes, which is precisely how these two robots have sex. And I am very amused by this fact. And
well, I mean, look, they refer to it directly as a security risk. I mean, the whole point of it with them being like, oh no, I would never interface with Megatron, is that what if he overloads my processes and kills me, and then comes to the conclusion that he wouldn't, because then he would be stuck there with a hunk of lifeless metal and be bored to death for millennia. But that's the risk, and that's the whole... But again, it comes down to that sort of transparency and vulnerability thing.
Yeah, the implication is definitely that you would only ever interface, and that's the robot word for sex, interface. Sorry, guys, we should have warned you. There's going to be some dirty talk on this podcast. So the implication is definitely that you would only interface with someone that you trusted.
Right, which probably a good idea, not to directly plug an Ethernet cord into your laptop and a stranger at Starbucks laptop.
Macy, tag your porn.
What if it's lubricated, Macy?
This is a family-friendly podcast, motherfucker.
Listen, you two.
Look, do you want to know how many times the word lubrication is used in that bit? Because it is a lot.
I think you're about to tell me. Do you have Control F on that computer of yours?
I haven't got it open.
Okay, I am going to answer this right now. Five. Five times.
Oh, five. Only five. That's not that many.
Yeah, well, look, one of the times it is used in conjunction with the word dripping, which I feel is just an asterisk.
So yes, future episodes will include vocabulary analysis.
Well, look, I think if we jump back to have a bit of a talk about the robot sex, I want to talk very briefly before we finish about the poetry in Victory Condition, because we haven't talked about that yet, and it's actually a huge part, I think, of why this has become a very popular, and it's resonated far beyond, you know, the bounds of a Transformers fanfic, is that is that it's a story about a poet, and it's a story about resistance poetry, and it includes
and the poetry is so beautiful.
The poetry is really good.
So beautiful. Like, I have been in fandom for 15 years at this point, and I have never read poetry and fan fiction that was as good as this. Oh my goodness. Please continue, Freya.
Well, the thing I wanted to say was because I just reread the story just in preparation for the podcast, is that I hit the scene where they're talking about, there's one poem that's being recited, which is about, it's sort of meta-poetry. It's about being a poet whose poems have been accepted by the elite and are being lauded and given awards because people are missing the point of them. And all the people who are at the top of the utopia heap have started patting themselves on the back about recognizing, you know, the literary merit of this poetry. And you're at a party and you go outside and talk to two people who have understood the poetry because they understand that it's about reflection of reality and violence and what it's actually like for the people on whose backs the empire is being built. And I had the thought when I was reading that it reminded me a lot of Siegfried Sassoon's war poetry from World War I. And because I will talk at length, at the slightest drop of a hat, about my favourite book in the world, Regeneration by Pat Barker, which has got a lot to do with World War I and war poets and conscientious objectors and the reasons why you might write war poetry. But it's this idea that he wrote these poems to show exactly what was going on, and then they're brutal and they're beautiful, but they're also a true description of what was happening on the ground in the war. And he was writing them to say to the people in charge, you know, yes, you can keep throwing young men into this bloody machine, and I understand that you're going to keep doing it, and probably nothing I can do or say. Even when he did object and get himself committed to Craig Lockhart because of his objections, is going to change that, but I'm going to make you look into the face of what it's actually like. I'm going to make you see the horror and the wounds, and you have to look at that because I've made it beautiful. And to me, that's what the point of this poetry was, in a sense. It was obviously it's recruitment for Megatron's uprising, but it was also saying, here, from someone who has been on the ground, this is what the cost is. Please look at the cost. You have to put this in front of you. But the people aren't accepting it. They're not going into the room to look at the child.
Can I read the last but one stanza of that poem? Because I think it's short enough to kind of get the gist of it.
Yes.
Okay, it says, and this is Megatron speaking to the two bodyguards, essentially, that are standing outside the fancy party, who know this truth already. And he says, let us build together the empire of unsheathed knives and hungers, where we will not lie in small rooms and say we want poetry when all we want is to live. Let us pave the streets in corpses. They are paved so already, and we cannot raise the dead, but let us leave them out next time. Let us bury lies instead of the living, whose mouths we stop up with stories. Let us build it soon, if not today. And this is why Astolat is the best.
Yes. The end.
Yes. Sorry, we just had to take a moment and like settle that. Yes, I wanted to say something about the other poem, All This Is True. I didn't really have a point to it, except that it reminded me of a poem by Omar Khayyam, which is four lines long, so I'll just recite it for you now. Here with a loaf of bread beneath the bough, a book of verse, a flask of wine, and thou beside me, singing in the wilderness, and wilderness is paradise enow. And this poem, All This Is True, is, I think this is where we come to Hope Punk. This is the moment of reconciliation and compromise.
When I was reading this, I was wondering, do you think that Megatron wrote that then, or was it a poem he'd already written?
I absolutely think he wrote it then.
Yes, I think he can't have written it until he's had that experience, because obviously the biggest change comes from Optimus Prime, with him having to face the fact of what he's remembering is not something that's perfect. But I think that poem can only be written after the second realization, which is that there are things that are going to keep existing no matter what, such as love and compassion and kindness, and the acceptance that perhaps there could be hope is what's in that poem.
It's been a few days since I've read the fic. I meant to reread it again. Was there a point in the beginning when Optimus finds out that Megatron is the poet, when Megatron says, maybe I'll share the next one with you, or something like that?
I think there was.
So I think that Megatron was already writing the poem, and then, because the beginning is, all this is true, that death is not a door but an end, and galaxies 10 billion years away are fading into endless night, flying from us faster than their light can shine. The stars one day will all go out, and all empires will be dust long since. So that's very sort of resigned, and that's him trapped in the dark with Optimus, thinking that they might never escape and that they will just die. And then the turning point is sharing the Vulcan mind meld, the interfacing with Optimus, and coming to this place of compromise and mutual acceptance. And that's when it turns, because yes, and this too is true, it will not be long. It's so good.
Well, I disagree. I still think it was all written after the fact, because he's saying...
You think it's all written after?
Yes, because okay. I think he's saying that if this is still true, the things that I believed are still true. I'm still fighting for this empire, but I have now added this new aspect to my worldview. And look, obviously, I think we're getting a little bit nitty-gritty about, did he write the first stanza of this poem, this fake robot in this fake fanfic? The author is dead. I say he wrote it after.
This is getting extremely meta.
Yes.
Like we have told our listeners time and time again, or rather, for the first time right now, this is a podcast of extremely deep literary merit.
Yes, and we are exceedingly serious, serious people.
Yes.
Yes.
But we
yes.
will use the word lubricant quite a lot.
Yeah, speak for yourself.
And this too is true.
And this too is true.
Hey everybody, thanks for joining us for this episode of Be the Serpent, a podcast of extremely, extremely deep literary merit. I can't quite believe that I live in a world where I actually just spent 45 minutes drawing parallels between Ursula K. Le Guin and pornographic Transformers fanfiction, but let's face it, this is 2018 and nothing is weird anymore. Anyway, we're so excited to be doing this podcast, and we have some even more exciting topics to talk about in upcoming episodes. On the next episode, 2 weeks hence on Valentine's Day, we'll be discussing personality taxonomies, which is just a fancy way of saying we're going to get really academic about Hogwarts houses and why people are so obsessed with them. So if you have a friend who is into stuff like that, maybe give them a heads up. In the meantime, feel free to continue the conversation with us. All our individual social media handles are listed on the show's About pages. We would love to hear from you. Questions, comments, breathless adulations? Contact us at serpentcast@gmail.com or at serpentcast on Twitter and Tumblr. And by the way, that shirt looks nice on you.